nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And as I said, on this Earth Day, we're going to take a look at bird conservation. We'll look at some bird threats. We'll do some bird watching with you. And certainly you can join in, too, as we move along and talk with our two guests. Andy Paulius is coordinator of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative and is with me in the studio. It's his first visit here. Andy, welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
And by phone, Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, our guest as well. Noel, great to have you.
Same here, Larry, and it's great to be with all your listeners and with Andy to talk about bird conservation here on Earth Day.
Yeah, it's a perfect day for it, isn't it? Andy, what's the general status of birds in Wisconsin?
Well, The general status, and this is something I actually learned from Noel, is that on average, about we call it the rule of thirds. So about a third are increasing, about a third are decreasing, and then the other third are pretty much staying about at the same levels they were for the last 30 or 40 years. We're really lucky in the bird world in that we have really good monitoring data for a large chunk of the species throughout the state and the region and the continent, which is a source of envy for a lot of the other taxa groups like insects and mammals and other things, which are much harder to monitor. But yeah, so in some ways, some species are doing quite well. And you think about birds like wild turkeys, which are increasing by about 25% per year from the early 70s, and Canada geese and sandhill cranes, things that are doing really well. But then there are a lot of other species, grassland species, some of the open country species that are undergoing alarming declines. So things like meadowlarks and some of the grassland sparrows, like Henslow sparrows, have declined by 80 or 90% in the last 30 or 40 years.
That's a lot. And the grassland birds, is it, Noel, what's the greatest threat? Is it just us?
Well, as our population increases, we certainly put more stress on using our land wisely, and we see conversion of land over to other uses that can certainly have a detrimental effect on bird populations. But there's also a lot of interest in the state to do landscape type work and do restoration management and really concentrating on what we can do for birds. So there's a lot of positive efforts going on also in the state. But at the same time, as Andy points out, there are some species that we're not able to address adequately, and they continue to decline.
Andy, you coordinate the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, and that's coordinating a variety of projects, isn't it? I know the Great Wisconsin Birding and Nature Trail is one of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Bird Conservation Initiative is essentially a partnership of over 165 different agencies, organizations, NGOs, businesses, and you can see all the list of those endorsing members on wisconsinbirds.org. And essentially, we try and take on priority projects that require some level of coordination and coordinated effort across the state and region. So we're hooked into a lot of the national and regional efforts as well. And so we've got projects like the Birding and Nature Trail, or coordinated monitoring projects that we'll talk about probably in a little bit, or even coordinated habitat initiatives. So we just had a big grassland bird symposium this winter, and we're going to have a series of regional grassland bird workshops this summer. So,
and Noel, as we look at the needs, in your mind, what are the greatest conservation needs we have in relationship to our birds?
Well, I think a lot of it is education and public awareness of the things that we do in carrying out our everyday lives and what impact those can have on birds. For example, we've talked about this issue in the past, Larry, about keeping cats indoors because they are mm-hmm. such an efficient predator of our birds and around our houses where we live. But things like windows, there's ways now to try to disguise windows or make them less attractive to birds flying into them because they see the reflection of outside vegetation. They think they can fly right into that vegetation. Of course, they encounter the pane of glass. You know, those are two of our biggest kind of single issues, are structures that birds run into, and being caught by predators such as cats are certainly two of the biggest threats. So just more awareness of things that we can do to try to help birds is a, I guess, a noble objective to have. And WBC, by Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, we call it WBC, by putting out issue papers and trying to do public education. We're trying to bring more people aware of what some of these issues are.
We have some callers online. Alan in Grant County wants to chime in here, so let's go to Alan. Hi, Alan. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. I wanted to know what the latest information is on the virtual disappearance of the whippoorwills in the Driftless region and the never-recovered grouse populations here from the 80s, and whether there's any correlation between the expansion of the turkey range and the diminishing numbers of ground nesting forest birds.
All right, some three interesting questions there, and I'm not sure where to go first. Let's start with Andy.
Well, I'll mention with whippoorwills, we've definitely had a lot of anecdotal evidence about whippoorwills and common nighthawks declining, and there are some states now that have redone their second breeding bird atlas, and Ontario just redid its breeding bird atlas, and whippoorwills and common nighthawks declined by 30, 40, 50% in just 15 years. So there's some big questions there. If I would have made a bet about what the first call we were going to get, I probably would have bet on whippoorwills, because I get that comment all the time when I go and talk at public meetings and stuff. We're not quite sure what the reason is for the whippoorwill declines. There's a number of competing theories. It could be that the forests have become a little brushier than they were. Whippoorwills like these sort of open grown forests, and they like being on the edge of big open areas to forage because they're flying around eating moths and other big bugs at night. But in order to address that, we're trying to get a little bit better data, and we've actually started a new citizen monitoring program this year to do nighthawk surveys and whippoorwill surveys. So we've got over 90 different people signed up across the state to do nightjar surveys, and it should be a fun time to get out at night and listen for those night birds.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe, Noel, you could talk a little about the turkeys. Have they had an impact on our grassland birds?
Yeah, turkeys and grouse seem like always come up, too, on these programs. And, of course, Bill Volkert loves to talk about the turkey interactions with other species. And as much as we know, all evidence indicates that there's no negative interaction between what's happening to grouse populations and what's happening to turkey populations. They tend to be pretty exclusive as far as any kind of interactions or one affecting the other. So I think we can discount that with quite a bit of a feeling of confidence. You mentioned grouse populations down in the southwestern part of Wisconsin. Last year, the WSO, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, held its annual conference down at Richland Center, and our banquet speaker that night talked about all the work that he's been doing on grouse down in that part of the state. And as for many species, you know, Andy earlier mentioned grassland birds and their habitat. Well, it really comes down to a habitat situation with grouse down the southwestern part of the state. Some of the land use practices, agricultural practices, and overall the kind of woodlands that are now present in southwest Wisconsin just aren't that great of range or habitat for grouse. So. I'm not sure we're going to see grouse populations bouncing back in that part of the state anytime soon.
And thanks again for calling. Pat in Menominee is up next. Let's go to Pat. Hi, Pat. Thank you for calling. Hold on a second, Pat. There. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, he mentioned bird stress, and I'm sorry to limit my concern so much right now, but I have this female cardinal who has just had constant panic attack from 6 in the morning till about 10. She's at our one basement window that's half out of the ground, and the computer's behind it, but it's turned off no matter what we put up on the inside. He mentioned what to do to disguise windows. I suppose the only thing you could do would board up the outside.
Well, there's other ways to handle it. I'm pretty sure of that. And both Andy and Noel probably have some. Andy, let's just turn to you first.
Sure. Well, the key there is that you want to reduce the reflection on the window. And so I know my in-laws had a male cardinal for a couple of springs that liked to wake them up at 4:30 in the morning every day. And they just simply put a little bit of a netting over that. And that pretty much solved the problem. Interestingly, and there's lots of those sorts of ideas on the WBSE website at wisconsinbirds.org if you go into some of the resources pages. So whether it's for collisions or whether it's stopping territorial cardinals from killing themselves on your windows. There's good reasons to do that sort of stuff. Interestingly, I actually had a few calls this spring about sandhill cranes even coming to people's windows and attacking the windows. So that sort of brings the problem to a whole new level, I guess. But yeah, there's lots of good resources on the web for that. And the key thing is cutting down the reflection.
And with a window like that, it's not one you look through very much anyway. A little bit of netting over the top of that window is probably going to do the trick.
Sure.
The hormones are really ranging this time of year, and that bird wants to fight that other male cardinal that he sees in the window. So you have to do something to break up the reflection, as Andy says, even if it's just, you know, covering with paper or whatever for a few weeks here during the spring, really, when they're highly territorial.
Okay. And, all right. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. And Bill in Milwaukee is up next. So let's go to Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious about the status. I mean, I know it's dwindling, it's bad, but of the loggerhead shrike and where, you know, if you could answer this, where I might be able to spot one.
Noel, you got an idea?
Well, good luck, Bill. It's really tough in Wisconsin anymore because we're seeing so few loggerhead shrikes migrating back into the state to breed. We may have anywhere from 2 to 6 to 10 pairs that get discovered during any particular breeding year now for the last a couple of decades, really. And it's one of those species we're not really quite sure what's happening. Obviously, this is not the heart of the breeding range, which is certainly the mid-south, but the populations are declining down there. And again, we don't know whether it's fire ants, whether it's pesticides that's killing a lot of the grasshoppers and other insects and invertebrates that the shrikes depend upon, whether it's a lot of monoculture, both agricultural and pine plantations, or really what is happening to loggerhead shrikes in the heart of their breeding range. And, of course, as the population declines in the heart of the range, it's certainly felt out on the periphery of the range, which includes Wisconsin. Those that do make it back into the state, and we certainly have plenty of habitat for shrikes here in Wisconsin, and the ones that do nest, they're very successful nesters. They raise big broods, maybe as many as 6 young. So there's no problems once they reach here. But we just don't have enough birds now being produced in the heart of the range to make it back to Wisconsin. So I guess that's one of the species that I'm not very heartened about the prospects of bringing that species back to its former prominence in the state.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Andy Polias, coordinator of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, and Noel Cutright, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, our guest today as we talk bird conservation, the threats, and bird watching with them. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're looking forward to your questions today as we talk bird conservation, bird threats, bird watching, bird identification with Andy Polios and Noel Cutright. Feel free to join in. We've got an open line or two. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Bob in Wauwatosa next. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I've got a question regarding pesticides. Given the huge quantity of pesticides that are being used on not only agricultural lands but also urban lawns, is anyone anywhere in the country doing systematic autopsies on birds to see if their tissues have significant residues of some of these chemicals? And if so, what are we going to do about it? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much for calling. Well, I'll turn to Noel Cutright first. Noel?
I don't believe there's any organization or any research interest that's really doing any kind of systematic look at doing autopsies or doing any kind of chemical analysis. It's usually on a case-by-case basis or on a particular study of a pesticide or a particular species, or when there's an outbreak of bird deaths, there may be a search for what the cause of it is. But as Bob mentioned, there's just so many chemicals in our environment today, and so many of those we don't understand very well. We do know that there are some that are definitely causing bird problems, and there's American Bird Conservancy and other organizations that have tried to place more restrictions on those or completely ban them from the market. I know when West Nile virus became prevalent here a number of years ago, it started out east and kind of worked its way west, and in New York, they have a very aggressive bird contamination program there run through the state, and they did a lot of autopsies of birds to see how many were actually being killed by West Nile, and what they were surprised to find were how many of them that had died because of various chemicals. And I think it kind of caused a few eyebrows to raise that it's probably a bigger issue than what we kind of think right now, but it seems like there's no really large concerted research effort to try to investigate how prevalent it is and which chemicals are causing the problems, which species might be most at threat, and it's just kind of a lost issue right now with so many other issues that we're having to deal with.
Yeah. Andy, a comment from you.
Yeah, I mean, from a practical perspective, for the listeners, there is a DNR hotline number, a 1-800 number you can get on the DNR website to report dead birds, either that you might suspect from West Nile virus or pesticides or whatnot. And we do necropsies on those if we get them in a certain amount of number that makes us suspect that there's some sort of an issue there. But I think the question's a good one, and that it illustrates, in a sense, why we need large partnerships, both at the state, regional, and national levels. You know, the tricky thing about birds is that they migrate, and they don't spend their whole lives in one place. And that makes it very difficult to figure out what's going on in a population. For example, with loggerhead shrikes, there could be things going on in Georgia or South Carolina where they spend the winter, and that's causing the declines in Wisconsin. And so So partnerships like WBC, like the North American partnerships and joint ventures, are very important, and we're really banding together to take on these big issues that require large scale cooperation. And the great thing is that there are things people can do, both in terms of what they decide to do in terms of buying products and putting stuff on their lawns or not putting stuff on their lawns. But they can also participate in a new project we have called the Bird Protection Fund, which is run by the Natural Resources Foundation, and I think everybody's familiar with that. You can see all about the Bird Protection Fund on wisconservation.org. And we're banding together to take on some of those big issues, whether it be pesticides or loss of habitat or collisions.
Very good. Thanks again for that call. Judy and Ryo, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question is, I have a neighbor who has a beautiful piece of property next to us. It's part natural prairie and part woods. There's a lot of cranes and pheasants back there, and every year they do a controlled burn to try to keep down invasive weeds. But my question is, what does that do to the birds at about this time of year, and when is a good time to do it? Because it is good for the grass, but it's got to be terrible for the birds.
Well, I don't know if it is or not. Andy, do you want to chime in? I suppose timing is critical.
Timing is critical, and it depends what species are there. The rule of thumb is that a lot of the birds are just starting to nest now into May and June, and a lot of the early nesters will also re-nest if their first nest is destroyed. So every year across the state, natural resources personnel are doing controlled burn to restore prairies and other habitats that are fire-dependent. And on some level, you do kill some of the very earliest nests, maybe a turkey nest or a woodcock nest, but most of those species will re-nest, and they take a lot of care to try and time those right so that it's going to have the least impact. And they also do fall burns as well. And those burns are great long-term for the habitat. There might be some short-term losses, but they're really important long-term.
Yeah.
When is a good time?
Well, I think there's a lot of burns taking place probably in the month of April. And then they'll probably get out again in the month of probably September into October.
So April and September are probably the two best months. Okay. Thanks, Judy.
Yep, thank you.
Dave and Phelps, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I have gotten into bird photography, and amazingly, I have found 80 species in my backyard. And a couple that have been really oddballs. One apparently was a Brewster Warbler Crossback. Mm-hmm. Got a bird today that I can identify. My best sources so far have been a birding friend in Wyoming who's in a network, and they've been able to identify some stuff for me. And then I had an unusual disease that normally is carried through finches that I found in a nuthatch. And I'd like to be able to report these things, but I really don't have a good source. Can you just give us some good sources of people to contact in the Audubon Society or what have you? I have contacted a gal in Milwaukee, but it's pretty sporadic her getting back to me. How do we get a hold of somebody if we've got an unusual bird or a problem?
All right. Noel, we'll start with you.
That's a good question, Dave, and I'm not sure what kind of birding resources are in the Phelps area. But a good contact to start with certainly is your Department of Natural Resources local office. I'm not sure, Andy might know whether there's an office in Phelps or what the closest one would be, but that's a good starting point. And they very often can steer you in the direction of someone who can help you with identification. Of course, it's getting a good field guide. You can do an awful lot on your own, and also looking up various field guides that are on the Internet now to as far as identification. But if you want to talk about issues or problems with birds, I would start, unless you know of a local nature center where you can go to, I would start with the Department of Natural Resources and take their suggestions and go from there.
Mm-hmm.
And there are there is an office in Eagle River that you can go to, and I'm sure there's some good birders that work there. But the great thing about the age of the Internet, too, and even Phelps probably has pretty good Internet access now, is if you're a photographer especially, you can take pictures of birds and send them to the birding listservs or WSO folks or whatnot, and you can get a good identification answer probably within minutes of when you send it online. Also, a really neat project by Cornell Lab of Ornithology is called eBird. And basically what eBird is a way to tell the world, essentially, what birds you're seeing at any one place at any one time. So we love having observations from the area up by Phelps because we just don't have that many people living up there. So that might be another good resource out there for you to use.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling, Dave. Appreciate it. Tim in Hayward is up next. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
I'm on the grouse because I'm old enough to remember before they put the season back in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And we built an enormous business up here at the lodge in fall grouse hunting. And when they reintroduced the fisher in the late 70s, within 4 years, there were no more grouse. And the economic effect of it, outside of the pure pleasure of hunting grouse, for this resort alone, it costs the local economy $200,000 a year. Because it eliminated, we had them flying in from Scotland to hunt grouse.
Well, let's get a comment from Noel Cutright on that. Noel?
Well, fishers are certainly a very efficient predator, and there's been concern about, for certain species, especially for some of the tree rapting hawks, the raptors. Especially goshawk, and what kind of impact are red-shouldered hawks. The fisher, reintroduction of fisher and really being established back in the northern third of Wisconsin quite nicely, what impact they're having on populations. I guess I've never heard specifically anything about grouse, but I'm sure that it's just another predator that, along with having more raccoons in the northern north woods. I mean, there's years ago, when I moved to Wisconsin 30 years ago, raccoons weren't all that common in the northern third of Wisconsin. Now they're common all the way up into the UP. So as predator populations change, they definitely put more pressure, and I guess that's also why we have the need for good habitat. If you provide good habitat for these species, they can overcome any kind of predator inroads that they can have on the populations for the most part. But specifically, I guess I've never read anything about fisher predation on grouse, but I'm sure that it does occur.
Yeah.
Well, the grouse, being a nocturnal and arboreal hunter, they take them right out of the roosting partridge, right out of the tree, and they also dine on the eggs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you know, Tim Isley, a friend of mine, he may be listening today, and he may have some information on that too, Tim. So we'll get another. Maybe we'll get another Tim to call in if he's got some ideas on that, because he's pretty active in the grouse area and might have some. So stay listening. We'll see what we can come up with. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. I don't know of any research that's really been done on that.
There haven't, at least in northern Wisconsin, we haven't done a lot of real recent research on ruffed grouse nesting ecology, but we do have really good data on population trends and hunter harvest, and while there could be some local impacts, whether it's around Hayward or whatever, with changing habitat, a lot of the forests have gotten older. It's be pretty hard to say that it was because of the fisher or not because of the fisher right now.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Tim. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Tom in Port Wing a chance to join in here. Tom, hi to you.
Hi. I got two comments about birds. I do a lot of driving in Wisconsin, and along this one stretch, I never saw meadowlarks, and all of a sudden 5 years ago there were some meadowlarks, and every year I've seen more.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, and even now south of Fort Wing, I'm seeing some meadowlarks, which I've not seen before, and even some bobolinks, which I think are similar. They like the open fields.
Well, that's some good news, Noel.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is, and one of the things we're seeing recent over the last decade or so, we're seeing more grasslands put in through various agricultural programs, whether it's a crop reserve program. And I used to joke, I live in Ozaukee County, north of Milwaukee County, and I used to tell people the biggest population of meadowlarks in Ozaukee County was the habitat along I-43 that goes all the way up north-south, because that was about the only grassland we had in the whole county. Now you go into the northern part of the county, and there's just hundreds of acres of grassland that have been reestablished. Of course, one of the problems we're having, some of that's going back into agricultural production now because of the price for many of our grains that we're seeing. Kind of a reversal in the building of grasslands. Andy can talk a little bit more about what's happening, I think, in the grassland area. We had a wonderful grassland bird conference a couple of months ago, and there's going to be some statewide meetings being held around the state to try to get more people involved with land management activities to focus on grassland birds. So, Andy, I'll throw it over to you.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, the great thing about that sort of call is that I think we really identify a lot of our lives with birds that we see going here and there in our backyards or in the farms that we grew up on. And I know a lot of people that grew up in rural areas just sort of assumed that meadowlarks would always be there, and that meadowlarks at one time were the western meadowlark was the seventh most abundant bird in Wisconsin. And now it's one of the least abundant. So big changes in the last 30 or 40 years. With the price of fuel going up and biofuels being all the rage and more food needing to be produced, agricultural land use is really in flux right now, and we're gonna get a new farm bill probably signed here in the next few months, and how that shakes out will really play a big impact on grassland birds. In the meantime, WBSE and all the different grassland conservation partners are banding together to see how we can implement conservation most efficiently with the resources we have, so we're working on picking areas where we'd like to focus on grassland bird management, and one of those areas is up by Port Wing. There's a lot of really neat agricultural grasslands sort of in the Ashland to Superior area, and great places to see bobolinks. In fact, bobolinks right now are probably winging their way back from Argentina. Should be here within the next week or so, depending on how the weather gets. And I always think it's really amazing that this little six-ounce bird has seen more of the world than 99% of us will ever see. But those are the sorts of things you can expect and support by supporting WBSE.
Thanks, Tom, very much for calling. Appreciate it. And by the way, Jim Packard will be filling in for me tomorrow, and he's doing a show on the Conservation Reserve Program with a fellow from Ducks Unlimited. So that's another. I might tune in for that one too tomorrow. Kathleen in Fifield, I believe, is up next. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, guys. I won't be able to hear you very well. I have a terrible hum, but I'm hoping you can hear my question. A friend of mine, I was quite surprised, said that she didn't believe in feeding birds, that she felt it's an interruption of nature. And I'd never heard that before, and I'm wondering if that might be the case and if it would make any difference, like between cities or out in the country even, or in the woods, that type of thing. And I'll take your comments off the air so I can hear you better.
Okay. Feeding birds or not feeding birds, is it good or bad? Well, I think all three of us are feeding birds, but Noel, I'll start with you.
Well, practically everything we do, you know, intrudes on birds in some fashion, whether it's building a new highway, whether it's harvesting a woodlot for lumber. Just about everything intrudes on the life of birds. So, you know, if that's the primary reason for claiming that they don't think birds should be fed, I just think it's a, you know, not really a realistic perspective. My perspective on bird feeding is that we certainly do it for our own enjoyment. That is true. But there is some research out there that shows, especially in tough times of the year, feeding birds can certainly help them come through. They come out of the winter in better physical condition and better able to nest successfully and raise more young. So there's some definitely positive indications out there, but there are still those that feel that, well, we're doing it just for our own enjoyment and not for the birds' enjoyment. I guess they're certainly welcome to that opinion, but I personally think that we're helping birds by feeding them, and of course we're helping ourselves to learn more about birds, appreciate their beauty, watch their behavior, and I think it's just more of our love of the outdoors here in Wisconsin if we feed birds and have them around in our daily lives.
Yeah,
I think it's especially important that, you know, we as sort of citizens of the earth and our kids, especially my kids, that you need to capture their imagination with nature, and they need to sort of get connected. And one of the best way I can think of is bird feeding. And even my 1-year-old now can sort of say chickadee. So, and that's because we've got bird feeders out in the backyard. And so one thing I would say is to the caller or others listening is take a look at your yard, if it's your yard you're thinking about, and think about what sort of things are missing. Is it food? Is it shelter? Is it habitat? And all those things you can work on in your yard. So whether it's putting up a bird feeder in the winter for those juncos or chickadees, or whether it's making a nice little brush pile for the winter wren who might stop over for a day in your yard on the way north. There's all sorts of things we can do at our local level, and in the process of that, we grow, I think, as people.
My wife swears she heard an oriole the other day, so we've got the oriole feeder out. And the oranges, I haven't seen one yet, but...
No, we haven't had any reports yet, but interestingly, my mother-in-law said the same thing, and we figured out this weekend that it was actually a singing fox sparrow, which in a lot of ways sounds a little bit like an oriole. And they're a boreal nester up on the tree line in the boreal forest, and they're coming through right now, and they have a really pretty song, and they sound a lot like an oriole.
There was a rose-breasted grosbeak sighted in Madison, and they very often come about the same time that the orioles do, so they should be here the next week.
Very cool. Kevin in New Glarus, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live out in the Rolling Hills to the east of New Glarus, and I was wondering, when I drive by, I often see something that I think is a raptor-type bird, but not larger like a red tail. I'm wondering if you might give me some hints. I know it's whitish and brown tints, but I'm not able to locate anything that says what it might be. Maybe it's a kite of some sort, or so I'm looking for hints.
Well, we can probably come up with some hints, but I don't think, given your description, Kevin, we're not going to get the exact answer, but there's this fairly small number of birds that might fit into that category, I think, right, Noel?
Yes, there is, and as you said, it's very difficult to start sorting through the raptors that are smaller than a red-tailed hawk, especially now we have a few new migrants coming into the state, like broad-winged hawks have made an appearance in the last week or two. They overwinter all the way down to South America, so they're just arriving back in the state. Of course, we have our resident Cooper's hawk, which is a raptor that people are seeing much more prevalent these days. It's a species that's really bounced back. We talked about pesticides earlier. It's bounced back from being depressed severely by the pesticides in our environment, and now they're nesting in, I say, every county park here in Milwaukee County. But people are seeing those a lot more, so you really need to get some field marks and look at habitat and flight characteristics and just kind of an overall feeling for the bird, and pick up a good field guide and start thumbing through and see if you can start narrowing down your choices.
Yeah, one thing that we do see is they like to hover in a spot over a type of over the field, and they're not a real big bird. I'll bet they're probably 6-8 inches long.
Well, you're talking about an American kestrel, then, if it's especially if it's hovering. It's our smallest falcon that we have.
Oh.
We have three species of falcon commonly in Wisconsin. The peregrines, of course, are bounced back from being completely gone from Wisconsin to now having more than 20 pairs in the state. We have merlins that are increasing in number, and we have American kestrel. Kestrels are actually declining some, and there's quite a bit of concern, especially in the eastern U.S., about kestrel populations. But it's a small falcon that hovers over looking for a mouse, or especially as we start getting into the grasshopper season, they love to feed on grasshoppers. They nest in cavities, so nest boxes can attract them, or hollow nest holes in snags. But if it's a small raptor and it's hovering, I'm sure it's an American kestrel. It used to be called a sparrowhawk.
Excellent.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Really is fun this time of the year to see some birds that we don't, at least in southern Wisconsin, for example, there's a couple of pair of loons on Lake Monona right now that are it's fun to be outside listening to them call. I think they had four pair of red-breasted mergansers that are just a beautiful, those males are really beautiful birds and a lot of fun to see. Lots of great things going on in birdland right now here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Bill in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My name's Bill Miller, and these two gentlemen know me quite well. I'd like to ask Noel and Andy to talk about the effect of lead poisoning on birds and ask Andy to give a little bit more explicit instructions how to find information on the WIPC website.
All right. Well, let's start with Noel, then we'll go to Andy. Noel, first.
Well, as Bill mentions, lead is certainly an issue. We talked about pesticides earlier. This is another metal that is quite prevalent in the environment, and there's a lot of concern that we need to do more to exclude that from our environment. Of course, you know, years ago we cut out lead as an additive in gasoline, but lead is still used in ammunition in many instances, and there's some good evidence that it definitely causes death of some of our water birds and also things like bald eagles. So many other states have taken some steps to try to reduce lead, not only in ammunition but also in fishing tackle, because lead is a commonly used material for weights. And Minnesota has really been very aggressive trying to come up with new materials that can be used for sinkers in fishing tackle. WIPC has just prepared a lead paper, and I think you're going to see more initiatives occurring in Wisconsin to try to remove lead, which, as I mentioned earlier, definitely causes mortality to our wildlife from our environment. And I think that Andy can talk about the WIPC webpage a little bit.
Yeah, Mandy, go ahead.
Sure. There was also, I just saw another great research article about lead in common ravens, and they looked at ravens' lead levels during and after the deer hunting season for birds that were doing what ravens do, which is fly down the roadways and pick up gut piles and dead deer and stuff, and then also raven lead levels outside of the deer hunting season, and there was big differences. So there's a lot of evidence that birds like ravens and eagles are picking up lead from not just from sort of benign sources, but or eating the actual pellets within a fish or something like that with high lead levels, but also with picking up little rifle fragments in these gut piles and stuff. So on the WIPC website, you can see all the issues papers. I think if you sort of scroll down the left-hand part of the website, there's a resources link, and then you'll see one that says issues papers. And there's all sorts of white papers there, from lead poisoning to reducing collisions to cats and birds, all sorts of good information there.
And what's the website address again?
WisconsinBirds.org.
Easy.
And if you go to just the homepage, click on wisconsinbirds.org, and down the lower left, it says, get the lead out, lead poisoning Wisconsin's birds. So you can go right, just click on that, and you can get to the issue paper on lead poisoning.
Bill, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Andy Polias is coordinator of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. Noel Cutright, our other guest, past president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking birds, bird conservation, bird threats, bird watching with our two guests, Andy Polias of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and he's, again, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. I mentioned, before we go back to the phones and so forth, a couple things I wanted to clean up. We were talking about burns and doing burns, and I know Steve Brown of the Great Lakes Cranberries phoned in and said that they do their burn in the fall when the birds have moved on, and it works great for them and no problems that way. So that's a good point. Also, I mentioned loons, and this has been a pretty good year for loons so far in the southern Wisconsin and Madison area.
Yeah, right. So those of us that work in downtown Madison have to get out and get our what I like to call our recommended daily allowance of birding in. And so what I've been doing lately is heading over to the Monona Terrace. And this spring has been amazing for loons. It's not uncommon to count 50 to 100 loons just on Lake Monona from the terrace. And that's probably because the lakes up north are still, I think for the most part, our callers can probably educate us on the current ice cover up north. But a lot of the lakes are still iced in up north. So the loons are sort of stacked up here. And it's been great listening to them call during the middle of the day. And there's a lot of concern about loons right now. There's been a big outbreak of botulism E on the Great Lakes this last few years. Hundreds of dead loons found in northern Lake Michigan last year. And all of our research that we do in the loon community suggests that adult survivorship is the main factor in loon populations. So when lots of adults are dying suddenly, that's really going to dramatically impact the loon population. So that's one of many sort of emergent issues that WBSE and partners through the Bird Protection Fund and other different avenues are hopefully going to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, Rebecca in Platteville has a question or comment, so let's go to Rebecca. Hi.
Hi. One, I want to know when I should put my hummingbird feeders out. And two, you mentioned the grape jelly, and I don't know where you can get the feeders. I have asked different places, and they always look blank at me, and I'm not sure where to get those so I can get the Baltimore Orioles also. And since you mentioned the loons, I have to say about 8 days ago, I was in Washera County outside of Wautoma, and there was one lonely loon out there, and it was around about 20, wasn't swimming together, but ring-necked ducks, which, according to my bird book, comes from the West Indies and are flying to Canada. So apparently they were on a rest, and they were diving down and eating, looked like snails from what I could see.
Yeah. Wow. that's great. Noel, comment?
Yeah, on hummingbirds, I tell people the first week in May is the time to get your hummingbird feeders out. It's not a magical time, but if you have them out by the first week in May, you should certainly catch the first ones that come into the state. As far as jelly feeders, you really don't even need to go out and buy anything. One of the things we've kind of done here in recent years, we start out with oranges because the Orioles love oranges when they first arrive. And as they eat out all the flesh, then we start dumping in some grape jelly into that cut orange half that's now kind of emptied, and we start feeding it that way. But you can use baby food jars or any real shallow, wide-open mouth jars that you might have around and wire those to an old swing set or to a picket fence or any place that Oriole can land and feed out of. But of course, you can go in and buy jelly feeders at a Wild Birds Unlimited store or some of the other retail markets that we have in Wisconsin. But, yeah, just think about if you were a bird and wanted to eat grape jelly out of a jar, what kind of a jar you would need, and put it out there someplace. Anchor it down and give a go at it.
Okay.
Yeah, we've purchased from Wild Birds Unlimited a couple of great feeders. My father-in-law made one for us, too. That's a, sort of a combination. It's got some prongs on the side where you can put the orange halves on either side and then the grape jelly in the middle, and they work pretty well. But I like your idea, too, Noel, of using up those orange halves. That's
yeah,
great.
They'll finally kind of deteriorate to the point where you need to, they won't, it will hold jelly all summer, but they'll hold it for several weeks and make use of it.
Andy?
Yeah, part of it, too, is thinking about oriole habitat, too. I think a lot of people don't realize that they might not be getting orioles, not just because of the food, but because they're not in the right spot, too. And the best Baltimore oriole habitat is sort of an open area, maybe next to a stream or sort of a riparian area with those big cottonwoods and a little bit of open, sort of more savanna condition. So they don't really like the deep woods as much. And people also don't realize that Baltimore orioles have declined by a fair bit in Wisconsin and even in the eastern U.S., and Baltimore Orioles spend most of their life down in the tropics in Central America, and it's very possible that you know what's happening down there could be impacting their population. So it might not just be food why you're not getting Baltimore Orioles.
We usually have about six around our feeder and around our area. One year, a pair built a nest in our birch tree, and you know what amazed me was how long that nest lasted through the winter and the winds and everything else. They're just amazing builders.
And sometimes they last longer than the tree that falls down the next year. Yeah.
This is a time you can also put out horse hair or dog hair or pieces of string and so forth, because that is something that the birds will use to weave into those nests.
Yeah, good point. Eric in Mazamania, it's your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hi, good morning, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Over the past year, I've had a smaller hawk every once in a while come around, fly around my yard, and I have several bird feeders in the backyard. The other day, I was out working in the yard, and I was looking at the ground, and all of a sudden, I heard a squirrel barking, and I looked up. And just as I looked up, this hawk came flying down and got a grackle right in midair. And it was, I guess for lack of a better word, it was one of the most exciting things I've seen. and the noise that it made when the claws hit the grackle and it fell to the ground was like a thump. And I'm just wondering, I guess, what kind of hawk that would be. It had a long tail, probably about 15 to 17 inches long, and on the back it was like a slate blue, slate gray.
You're doing a good job of describing a Cooper's hawk.
Yeah, that's right.
And they have the long tail. They have rather short, rounded wings so they can maneuver around obstacles, and that makes them very adept at maneuvering around shrubbery in your houses and feeders to try to catch birds, which they feed primarily on. And of course, morning doves they love, and of course, grackle is not too far off body size from a morning dove. So, and you had with the kind of the slate blue or gray back, that's the color of the back of an adult bird. So I'm almost 100% sure that you had a Cooper's hawk.
Yeah,
wow. It was an exciting thing to see, and it sat on the ground with the claws and the grackle for about 30 seconds to a minute, just looking at me. And I was just looking at it, and finally it took off, and it wove its way between a couple of lilac bushes, probably about 8-9 feet off the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things that not many of us get a chance to see. And my wife, as I mentioned once before on the show, but my wife this late winter when we had some open water on Monona, an eagle came and took a goose that had gotten out of the water and was on the ice, just sort of resting there, and that was quite a sight for my wife to see too. And you never forget, is it, Eric? Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. That goose wound up being fed by eagle and some crows, and a fox got out there later on and was feeding on it. It was quite a day. Joy in West Bend, your turn.
Hi, thanks for having this program on my nature-loving mother's birthday, Earth Day. My question is about balancing things that help save the earth and bird conservation. What about wind generators? I heard recently on this radio station that wind generators can decrease the population of bats considerably. And what is the latest research about wind generators impacting
bird mortality? Tell you what, that's something we'll take up in just a minute. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Andy Polias, coordinator of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, and Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And we'll take up that wind generators and bird mortality issue in just a few minutes here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking bird conservation, bird threats, bird watching today with Andy Polias of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative and Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Happy to have them with us, and thank you for listening in. And if you enjoy programs on birds, I did want to mention before I forget a couple of shows that I've got coming up. On May 2nd, Bill Thompson has come out with the Young Birders Guide, and we'll be talking with Bill about that guide and about birding with him. That's on the 2nd of May. And then May 6th, Ken Kaufman has a new book out that I'm almost finished reading. It's called Flights Against the Sunset. Fascinating book, and you don't really have to be a hard-nosed birder to be able to read this book and enjoy it. It's a great book, and a story about his love of birds and his sort of his relationship with his mother, too. And we'll be talking with him on the show on May 6th. But we had a question relating to wind generators and birds and mortality issues. And I want to go to Noel Cutright for some comments in that area. Noel, what do you have to say about it?
Yeah, I've been very involved with this issue now for a couple of years. I've been doing surveys out in the field for proposed sites with my son for the last several months, and completed a study back in 2005. And of course, we're doing all these studies to try to determine what the potential impact of constructing wind turbines might be on bird populations. And of course, there's a lot we don't know yet. And as we get more and more wind turbines built in Wisconsin, we'll be doing fatality studies to determine how many birds are being killed by turbines. But all the evidence to date points out that, yes, anything you put up into the air, birds will run into them. So if you construct a large communications tower or a large wind facility, there will be a certain amount of birds that fly into them. But I also tell people to place in perspective that, and I mentioned this earlier at the beginning of our program, windows kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of birds here in Wisconsin every day. In fact, I tell people that every residence in Wisconsin, every house, kills probably at least one bird a year. So when you place that in perspective, I believe that wind turbines will probably kill 2 to 3 birds a year. That's my best estimate based upon the studies that have been done here in Wisconsin, but also elsewhere. But we need to continue this work to better understand the impact it will have on birds. And of course, as Joy mentioned, bats is a concern. Bats mortality has been greater than bird mortality for certain wind facilities around the country. So we're involved in doing acoustic studies, looking for dead bats under operating windmills also, to try to get a better handle and get a better feeling for what the real threats to these birds are, mm-hmm, and bats are.
And there is also another one of the issues papers I mentioned before on the WisconsinBirds.org website that does sort of give you a good overview on the latest thinking of birds and wind power. And there's a lot of good internet resources there to get you up to speed on all that's going on.
And to show you the interest, We Energies is hosting a large national conference in late October this year. I've invited the National Wind Coordinating Collaborative to hold their Wind Wildlife Research Meeting, which is the 7th. They usually have them every 2 years, to come to Milwaukee in late October. So we're going to have between 250 to 300 people involved in research with wind and wildlife convening for a couple of days in downtown Milwaukee to hear the most recent research findings and begin to get a better understanding of what the situation is.
No, great. Joy, I thank you for that question. John in Germantown has a question or comment. John, let's go to you. Thanks for calling.
Well, you really loaded my guns with the last few comments here. I wanted to point out that it's not just windows, but feral cats and people that let their cats run loose during the day that kill millions of birds in the state every year. But getting to my other point, I've been up to Kettle Moraine Forest many times, Mothy Lake especially, up there during the week, and I just had a kestrel fly in front of me on the highway here. I've seen loons up. This time of the year is a great time to go up to Mothy Lake or some of the lakes up in the northern Kettle Moraine. You'll see loons out on those lakes feeding and resting. So I just wanted to make that comment, and thank you for letting me make the other comment as well.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, this is great. We got live bird watching coming in. For other people that are looking for bird watching opportunities, this is sort of the time of the year to go bird watching. The Natural Resources Foundation is doing a real big field trip offering this year, just centered around birds. We have almost 60 different bird-related field trips across the state from May all the way through October. Everything from warblers at Wyalusing State Park in May to whippoorwills in the central Wisconsin to all sorts of weird stuff. Osprey banding, trumpeter swan banding, some really neat things that are more experiential as well. So you can go to wisconservation.org and get more information about those field trips. I think members get first crack, but they're open to the general public as well. So there's no excuse not to get out there and go bird watching.
Lots of opportunities, 50 to 60 of them just coming up in that area alone. Bill and William and Presque Isle, it's your turn. Hi, William. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I've lived up here for 35, 37 years, something like that. We've fed birds with multiple large feeders. This is up by in Presque Isle Township, up near the Michigan line. And we used to have masses of evening grosbeaks in here, hundreds probably at sometimes. And I know the population's declined. I know Cornell now is stating that the population is beginning to come back. But all of those sites that are reporting that are all out east. Has anybody noted any kind of a regrowth in the population here in the Midwest?
Hmm. Well, Noel, I'll start with you.
Not really. It's certainly a real concern, William, of what's happening to our evening grosbeaks. The actual breeding population may actually be increasing slightly in Wisconsin, but the birds that come down in the wintertime have declined severely. And as you mentioned, Cornell scientists and other scientists are really trying to figure out what might be happening. We just don't have a good feeling, and I haven't seen any postulated reasons why they're declining. Obviously, they nest primarily in arboreal forests, and those are undergoing a lot of changes and will continue to undergo a lot of changes, especially as global climate effects become better known and start exerting their influence on the habitats. But what the future for evening grosbeaks are, I have a hard time trying to look in my crystal ball and coming up with an answer for that one.
Yeah. Andy, any comment from you?
Yeah, and I'd just say his observations aren't unique. I mean, you hear that all over the north, that the wintering population of grosbeaks has really declined. As Noel said, our population is actually increasing, our summer birds, and that's probably largely due to the sort of regrowth of conifers all across the northern forests. But the latest I've seen is that there's some hypotheses that evening grosbeaks really exploded in the early and mid-1900s out east and weren't necessarily nearly as common there before, with some really big outbreaks of spruce budworm across the eastern boreal forest. And it's just a hypothesis, and that those sorts of things are equalizing or balancing out, and so these populations are changing. But it does sort of bring up a point I had wanted to mention, that we take for granted, I think, a little bit all the ecosystem services that these birds provide. And there's been lots of really good studies out there, both in the tropics and in the temperate forests, that where they basically throw big drapes over trees to keep the birds from getting to the trees, and then look at insect population and tree health and stuff. And there is no doubt that the birds are a critical component of those forest ecosystems. And the trees don't do very well in the absence of
of the birds,
of bird caterpillar predation. So
I think this also highlights the reason why we need money to do this. And one of the new ways that your listeners can help take action now so we can always enjoy birds is to donating through the Bird Protection Fund, which is a new fund. The Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin is partnering with WBC and others to erect, and they have a number of priority projects, whether it's better understanding golden-winged warblers or protecting stopover habitat during migration. But you can go online at wisconservation.org, and there's you can click right on the Bird Protection Fund. It talks all about it, why we need it, and you can actually make the donation online to this fund to help these various priority projects that we have are undertaking here in Wisconsin.
Oh, excellent. William, thank you again for calling. Shelley in Polk County, it's your turn. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello, gentlemen. My question is in regards to northern flickers. I think they're also called yellow-bellied stab suckers. Several years ago, we had a pair that set up in our yard, and we thought it was very entertaining for the first year or two. And then now we have a large colony setting up. And my concern is, are they pretty destructive? Will they start killing the trees that they nest in?
I doubt it, but Andy, a comment from you?
If it is a flicker that you have, and I assume it probably is, they love sort of savanna-like conditions or yards, and they need dead or dying trees in order to create a home, and they'll excavate a home in like maybe a dying aspen tree or a dead limb on a tree. So my suspicion is that the flickers aren't targeting healthy trees, that they're mostly targeting trees that are either already dead or are in a serious state of decay. So it might be a good sort of proxy arborist for you. Flicker populations are actually, that's a good example of without monitoring that we'd really be missing the boat, because flickers are still thought of as being fairly common. You can see them right in downtown Madison, or you can see them out in the middle of the North Woods. But they've actually declined in the last 45 years by almost over 3% per year. So it's a pretty steep rate of decline. And so, you know, a lot of those birds of the open landscapes like flickers, they like to feed on the ground and eat ants and all sorts of bugs on the ground, are really, really not doing too well. So I guess in the near term, I'd count it as a blessing that you have a nice flicker population in your yard.
Yeah.
Well, Shelley mentioned sapsuckers, too. And the yellow-bellied sapsucker and the northern flicker, yellow-shafted flicker, are completely different species. And the sapsuckers are often pointed at of causing damage to trees because they do drill holes to eat the insects that are attracted to the sap, but also drink the sap. And they may do some weakening of trees, but they're not going to cause gross mortality and have a lot of sapsuckers around. Just with flickers around, you're not going to cause a major problem with your trees.
Okay.
Right.
I did have, they are nesting in like birch and aspen, and there is one tree that is still alive, but it has at least 3 or 4 nesting holes in it. So I was just concerned if that was going to be an issue later on in its life, in the tree's life. But thank you very much again for taking my call, and gentlemen, have a good afternoon.
Yep, you as well, Shelley. Thank you for calling. Mike in Castle Rock, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I have a nest of tree swallows. They're not here yet, but I was wondering, I'd like to put up another box. How close should I put another tree swallow box to an existing one?
How close can you put one?
Yeah.
Okay. Noah, what do you think?
Well, tree swallows can withstand pretty close neighbors. They're almost somewhat of a colonial nesting, and we have a large research project at the UWM Field Station near where I live. And there they have boxes on a grid about every 100 feet. And you can actually have tree swallows nesting in those boxes side by side that are that close together. So as opposed to bluebirds, we usually talk about 300 feet for bluebirds. Tree swallows, you can squeeze those in a little bit. And I would say 100 feet.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Jerry in Amherst, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, good afternoon. Say, I'm from Amherst, but I'm actually in Green Bay, and you may have spoken to this earlier in the show, but there's a flock of pelicans flying over my head here, and I thought maybe you could speak to the pelican population in the state.
Pelican population is on the increase, isn't it, Noel?
Yes, it is. It's one of those exciting things to watch as we gain new birds coming into the state and watching them expand. And during the Breeding Bird Atlas, we had which was between 1995 and 2000. During that period, we had the first confirmed nesting of white pelicans in the state, and now we have hundreds nesting on the islands off Green Bay. We have a large colony nesting at Horicon, and they're setting up shop in a few other locations. And I guess I would see this trend continuing with pelicans probably starting to breed along the Mississippi River and some of our other inland lakes, wherever they can find an island or maybe a peninsula where they can build their ground nests. We can expect to have pelicans, I guess, in our future for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And Marge in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Marge.
Hi there. Say, I was at the Prairie Chicken Count this weekend outside of Plover.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning after the chicken count, we went to look at birds in the Plainfield portion of Washera County, and we ID'd by sight and sound 62 species of birds. It was, as Professor Kent said, it was sensory overload because we had so many beautiful birds. One bird that only my girlfriend and I saw, because Professor Kent was off in his car, and we spotted a small bird. It was a sparrow-like size, and it was walking on the ground 15 or 20 feet away. I thought maybe it was hurt because it didn't seem to mind that we were so close. And it had a thin bill, thin legs, and when I look at my bird book, it looks like it could be a water pipit. Is that a possibility? The beautiful buff breast and the black eye markings were predominant?
I think it could be.
Were you in an ag field or near a sort of a farm field?
Oh, yes. You know, right near Buena Vista, the beautiful fields where the prairie chickens are, so there was lots of water, much more water than Professor Kent Hall had seen for a long time. Does that sound like that could be a bird in migration? And
yeah, I think you've probably hit it right on the head. There are very few small brown birds that walk, you know, 1 foot in front of the other. And if you notice, he was probably wagging his tail a little bit every now and then, too.
A little bit. It was in the walking, I considered it a little bit of a waddle.
Yeah.
Yep.
Does that sound somewhat familiar?
Yep. It's probably an American pipit, and he or she is on his way up to the tundra to do his or her thing here in the next month or so. So.
Oh, goodness. Good. That's
good
great.
Sighting.
Somebody's going to owe me a cafe latte.
Excellent job, Marge.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Marge. Thanks a lot for calling. Amazing how those little birds make that long, long trek.
Larry, if I can for a second, yeah. I was also at the Prairie Chicken Festival this weekend, and it was a great festival. And of course, prairie chickens need no sort of help in promoting themselves just because they have such a great display and are so cool. But a lot of people don't realize that. Well over 600,000 Wisconsinites actually take specific trips from their home to do recreational bird watching. So whether it's at the Prairie Chicken Festival or whether it's to all the great spots on the Birding and Nature Trail, it's really big business. And, of course, 1.5 million of us are at-home bird watchers. So provides a lot of money to the economy. And I'm sure the local gas stations in Plainfield and Bancroft were overflowing with birders this weekend.
Cheryl in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I was wondering, I saw a robin that had been killed by a car. I'm going to guess that it was a male because it had the red breast. So I'm wondering, you know, what happens to the mate? you know, is she sitting there waiting for him to come back and she's on eggs or chicks? I mean, I'm just kind of wondering what happens when one mate dies.
Noel, do you want to take that?
Well, it will vary by species on how well one parent can go ahead, but we're early enough here in the nesting season that there's not many robins probably on eggs yet, even though there might be a few here in the southern part of the state. And we still have robins probably already still migrating through the state, too, heading for Canada. So they'll usually pair up okay and or find another mate and continue their nesting. Sometimes if it happens later in the season when you have young in the nest, the one parent will be able to carry enough food to bring the brood off. Many of our species, only one of the sexes feeds the bird. So every species is different on what works for them, or what works for that species the best. But I guess I wouldn't worry about the female finding another mate in this situation.
All right. Thanks, Cheryl, for calling. And Greg in Withy, it's your turn now. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. I have a mystery bird. We moved into our house about 4 years ago, and he shows up every spring, and day and night, all day long, he swoops from about 120 feet down to 80 feet, and he flutters his wings, and you get the whoosh. But it's a full octave lower than a metal mourning dove when it takes off. I haven't been able to get a picture of him because he's just too quick and he's always flying. But I also hear a call from up there that sounds just almost like a hen turkey, just kind of a cluck, 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 well, cluck, cluck sound.
That sound, huh? Well, Andy, what do you think?
I'm guessing if he's near a wetland, I think what he's probably describing is the aerial display of the male Wilson snipe. I think.
Okay, now does this go on? He does it from first light to last all day long.
Well, he might be a particularly revved up Wilson snipe, but that could be, that's one of the birds that does sort of an aerial display, and he'll make sort of descending two 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 as the air is going through his primaries. But
he drives me nuts. It's 4 years now, and it does the same thing, displays all day long and up and down, and I haven't had anybody be able to identify him for me.
Well, check out Wilson Snipe. Noel, what do you think?
I would agree with that. The sound when they're in the flight, that's actually making by the air passing through their tail. If you'll watch, they'll spread their tail feathers, and the wind going through the tail makes that sound. But as you mentioned, when they're on the ground or perched on a post or something, they do have an auditory sound that they make with their voice boxes like other birds that has kind of a clucking sound. So
right.
I think Andy's right on with the Wilson Snipe.
Okay, I'll have to look at the tail and see if that spreads about the right time. So.
Yeah.
All righty, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. And Andy, I want to just remind people again that the website for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative is Wisconsin Birds. Is it birds? Yeah, birds, yep. Plural. WisconsinBirds.org. And Noel, with the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology or the Breeding Bird Atlas, what have you got, a little website there for us?
Yes, I do. And we recently changed it. Now it's easy to remember. It's just WSOBirds, all one word, .org.
WSOBirds.org. Well, as always, it's a real pleasure, Noel. Thank you so much. Andy, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Anytime.
Andy Paulus is coordinator of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. Again, it's wisconsinbirds.org. Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Pleasure to have them with us, and we'll get them back and we'll do it again. And thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.